Welcome back to the second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome back. If you just joined us, this is a two-hour show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, trying to explore whether we have more in common than divides us. In the first hour of the show, we ask questions that matter, avoiding politics, instead focusing on the issues that underlie politics and current events, issues that affect us all locally and globally. In this, the second hour, we feature in-depth interviews with local, national and international guests from the arts. And the show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel that discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. It's all a question of balance. If you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts of all my past shows there, and you can connect with me on social media should you wish, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, etc. So again, the show website is itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing stand-up comedian and comedy writer Sadia Azmat. Born in Essex, England, Sadia started writing and performing comedy professionally after a chance encounter in a call centre helped her to discover her mentor, professional comedian and author Deborah Francis White, who introduced Sadia to the UK comedy circuit. Within 2 weeks of meeting Deborah, Sadia found herself performing to an audience of 80 and hasn't looked back. Sadia's debut, called Please Hold, You're Being Transferred to a UK-based Asian Representative, directed by Deborah Francis White, was featured on the BBC radio show Front Row and performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Not long after, Sadia was shortlisted for the Funny Women Awards final in London. Her debut full-length show, I Am Not Malala, played at the Edinburgh Fringe and led to Sadia being featured on British Muslim TV's Sisters Hour. Sadia has appeared on the BBC World Service and has written a short for BBC Comedy Short, which features top British comedy talent. Known for her forthright observational comedy about her experiences as a British Muslim woman and also cross-cultural issues about race and religion, Sadia has appeared at comedy clubs and festivals around Britain, as well as contributing writing to British newspapers. She is currently working on a new stand-up act. Welcome to the show, Sadia.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's great to hear you all the way from England.
Yes.
You've said that you can't remember a time when you haven't been writing and enjoying comedy, but I was wondering whether you can remember the first thing that made you laugh and when you became aware that it's possible to create laughter in others.
Yes, one of my earliest experiences was I was on a plane and it was business class or economy probably, and me and my family obviously were Asian and the rest of the people on the plane were white. And I remember my little brother was making a lot of noise, and so my older sister, she was a bit sarcastic, and that kind of made people laugh on the plane. And that's when I realized that humor is so powerful and it could be used as a defense mechanism in some cases. But I really like the way that it diffuses attention on the plane. This was obviously before all the issues we have on planes, obviously, when I was quite younger. Because it was live as well, it really demonstrated how effective it can be rather than being, you know, angry or sad. It's a really interesting and strong emotion, I think, to make people laugh.
Yes, yeah. And it's interesting how times have changed a bit with that, because I know, I think there was that British girl who made some comment, you know, at security saying, oh, for goodness sake, it's not like I've got a bomb or something. And then, you know, she got, she was in, you know, the holding place for
a long time.
Yes, many hours. It's like, yeah, you know, nothing funny going on around security these days. But
no.
So what did you first, what did you first start writing?
To be honest with you, I can't remember when I wasn't writing. I did English literature in college, and I've kind of always been kind of jotting down notes, and it's become a bit more formalized when I met Deborah, because she kind of made me see that there's a little bit more to it than perhaps just a joke. And I think in the beginning I was doing a bit more opinion writing, so all throughout my late teens and early 20s as well, I was doing a bit more opinion writing, and so there is a bit more structure and kind of setup and punchline when it comes to stand-up. I know a lot of acts who are brave, and you know, they just go on stage and they kind of riff and devise their material that way, which I think is a great technique as well, something that I'm doing a bit more, because I think the more you do it, the more your brain is kind of ready to kind of do things on the spur of the moment rather than having everything pre-planned. But I think writing is just such a passion of mine, so I frequently write, and I've always been writing for one reason or another.
Yes, yeah. When you were saying that, I was thinking maybe it's a bit like, you know, rappers when they do rap battles.
Mm.
They have all their like little things ready in advance. It's like Oscar Wilde used to as well. You know, you have your sort of phrases and witticisms, but then how you put them together in the moment is you know, the thing. So sounds
that's
a bit like
art,
that.
Yeah. Ad-libbing, because sometimes you can't prepare for the situation and what's going to happen in the room. You can never prepare. Like, for example, our job is to call everything out in the room. So if the lights went off, you wouldn't just carry on your material verbatim. You'd need to respond and keep it engaged and dynamic. So it's really thrilling, and it's quite... quite exciting as well.
Yeah, that's true. It must be a lot of adrenaline, and of course you know, have hecklers sometimes, don't you? I don't know whether in your audiences, but there's some people who feel like they want to take on the comedian, isn't there?
Absolutely, yes. To be honest with you, I've been really surprised, because I wasn't really ready for hecklers, and I have to say that my hecklers are really polite. And I think someone along the way, they gave me good advice about hecklers, and basically what it is they're just someone who wants to interact. So if you look at it like that, rather than perhaps taking it too personally, then you can have a lot more fun with it, because how you play with it, that's also your job as a comedian. So getting upset and you know, agitated isn't really the best way out, I think.
Yes, yeah. You mentioned Deborah Frances White, and I was talking with my guest last week, the painter William Kelly, about the significance of having a good mentor, and I know you were fortunate to find her. I'm wondering how it came about and how you feel it's helped you.
Oh, it's been invaluable. I could spend the whole interview just talking about that in itself. You raise a great point. For me, it helped change kind of like a perception of what could be to a reality of what is, and that's how significant it was. So I was working in a call center, and you know, you have your one-to-one appraisals with your manager, and so my manager was like, you know, what do you want to do in the call center? And I was like, look, I don't want to do you know, sitting in this call center. I want to be out of here. I like writing. So he got me in touch with the editor of the magazine that we have as a monthly magazine. And Deborah happened to be on the cover in a very sexy pose on a bed with a half-dressed man, so very exciting. Yeah. And she was promoting her show at the time, which was called How to Get Anyone to Want to Sleep with You, which obviously is another thing that I could use a lot of tips with. And so I contacted the editor, gave me Deborah's contact details, and said that Deborah would be happy to meet me. So we met for dinner in Camden, which is where Deborah lives in London. And I brought along some of my samples of what I've been writing. And Deborah quite rightly said, you know, these are jokes. And I said, yeah. And I said, I really want to be a writer. And she said, why don't you try stand-up? And because I think the way we were talking, you know, and she could see something in me. And 2 weeks later, as you quite rightly said, we literally kind of talked about my experiences in the call center, and Deborah really, really helped me see that it's not, it doesn't have to be something formulated on paper, and sometimes the real stories that you have are the most compelling. And so my first 5 minutes was basically about my experiences being a Asian in a UK call center and having British customers complain to me about Indians, and obviously I'm of Indian origin to some degree, so it was kind of like really well received. And I think at the time outsourcing of call centers to foreign countries was a very touchy subject in the UK, so it struck a chord with a lot of viewers and audiences.
Yeah, and this is your UK based Asian representative.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is funny. Well, the first clip I'd like to play is from Things I've Been Asked as a British Muslim. Can you tell us how you came to make this?
Yeah, absolutely. So the BBC were doing some comedy shorts, and they wanted to feature some British Muslim acts. So they asked me, a few topics of what I might want to discuss. And I think that, Muslims are always in the media for one reason or another, but it's always kind of samey kind of news stories. It's always pretty intense and dramatic. And we have a lot of everyday kind of issues that we struggle with that are quite funny, but not always, hardly portrayed. So I wanted to talk about the difficulties of kind of trying to date in a headscarf, and sometimes, the preconceptions that come along with looking or dressing in a certain way. So it all came quite naturally to me. It didn't take me long to write at all.
No. And this is obviously a visual act. We're going to play the audio from it, and not the whole clip, but give our listeners an idea anyway. So this is sure. Things I've Been Asked as a British Muslim by Sadia Azmat.
Can you answer any questions about Islam, Sadia? People treat me like I'm a sheikh. They come up to me and expect me to give them the Muslim verdict on things. That's a lot of pressure. I mean, anything I say is going to represent the views of 1.57 billion Muslims. You're lucky if I could tell you something that 10 Muslims agree on.
So, just to be clear, you're in favour of electric cars, gay marriage and wind turbines, and you're against childhood obesity, female genital mutilation and Hollyoaks.
Yeah.
Great. As the official spokesman for the entire Muslim population, we now know what every single Muslim in Britain thinks of these very important issues.
But I'm not the official spokesman. Does racism make you angry, Sadia? Does racism make me angry? Does racism make me angry? Well, not really. I've got enough other to deal with. Like thinking about what I'm going to have for lunch today. I can't think about racism. I wouldn't get anything else done. People come and report racism to me like I'm the racism police. You know who I report racism to? My white friends. They get more upset about racism than I ever could because they understand it. Well, some of them are related to slave traders. Am I right, Ben Affleck? Plus, I can't be bothered to organise rallies and protests. It takes proper effort. Got to send out invites, make sure people turn up and do banners. And after all that, there's a good chance you might get arrested. I don't need that shit. As a lifelong headscarf wearer, I spend every day trying not to get arrested. Is it difficult fasting during Ramadan, Sadia? Well, let's put it this way. You've heard of the 5-2 diet? Think of Ramadan like the 30-0 diet. 30 days where you're only allowed to eat between sunset and sunrise. But you know what I find more difficult than Ramadan? The stupid questions I get asked by non-Muslims every year. Questions like, oh, do you need to fast for the whole month straight? Well, no, because I would die. We don't just fast from food. Like, it's customary to fast the entire body. So we also fast our eyes from things we shouldn't see. Offensive, immoral stuff like hardcore pornography or the Daily Mail. Being a Muslim, is it hard fitting in with British people, Sadia? A big mistake I make with my friends is trying to fit in all their conversations, even if I have no idea what they're talking about.
Oh my gosh, did you see last night's downturn? My sister's dead.
Actually, this is a bit embarrassing for you, but they've increased their stronghold in the Yemen.
You can almost hear the tumbleweed going across there. Well, that was a clip from my special guest this week, Sadia Azmat. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com. It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, this is Jackie from Integrity Event Planning. Are you coordinating an event? Don't know how you'll get it all done? Stop sweating the small stuff. We plan everything from family events to fundraising and corporate events. Contact Integrity Event Planning for your next event. Check out our website, integrityeventplanning.com. Integrity, it's what sets us apart. With 16 years of experience, we negotiate with your bottom line and needs in mind. So sit back and relax and let us serve the champagne. We've got this.
For your next event, visit integrityeventplanning.com. That's integrityeventplanning.com.
Dream, baby, dream.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the art, stand-up comedian and comedy writer, Sadia Azmat. Various comics, Sadia, such as Tina Fey, have commented on the difficulty for women in comedy, both in gaining access and also this belief that women can't be funny for some reason. I'm wondering whether you found this to be an issue for you or whether being Muslim and Asian are sort of more present barriers.
Yes, there are days where sometimes I think, you know, you can, I suppose, I agree with what Tina says. For example, on the comedy circuit, that, you know, there are plenty of stories that you hear quite regularly about promoters only wanting like a quota, so one woman on the bill versus like 10 men on the act. So I definitely think that the accessibility for men is far more easier. I just think that there are ways that, you know, you kind of have to use what you have, really. So, you know, I think when I started out, I was like, oh, you know, I'm just being picked because I'm, you know, the brown comic, or I'm just being picked for those reasons. But a lot of people, you know, they said you just have to use what you have. And I think you know, I know this sounds really cheesy, but I think if you stop viewing things as like a barrier and try and maybe look at solutions of how to work around things and just keep resilient, keep determined, those things will kind of become smaller and smaller the more progress that you make. But those kind of issues definitely do exist.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, like in so many areas, it's just a case of women having to keep chipping away and doing it, as you're saying, you know, just keep trying to do it. Yeah.
Yes.
What would you say is the main impetus behind you wanting to perform comedy, you know, rather than, you know, a dramatic sort of representation of the issues that you talk about?
For me, I think that the creative license to be honest is so so exciting, and it's just so beautiful. It's like, you know, it always comes down to this line: politicians have to lie, comedians have to tell the truth. And I think it's so important, and I think unfortunately, due to the state of things, our ability to be able to speak freely without worrying about offence or being politically correct, our ability to be so open is unfortunately not as kind of not as prevalent as it used to be, and comedians fight for that every day. It's really, really important. And for example, I think it's harder to perform new material because you might, it's harder to be freer, because if somebody's filming you on their phone, you know, if they put that online, they could potentially wipe out someone's career. So unfortunately, even when you're trying out new material, you have to be so careful these days. So for me, I respect the arts so much because it's not always just about being made to laugh or to make the audiences laugh. It's not always just about that. It's also being able to touch them in a way that they forgot that they could be touched, if that makes sense.
No, I agree. I mean, I think comedy is a way that you can also present certain material that perhaps people wouldn't be open to thinking about in sure. other formats. Yeah, so it can 100%. Be quite powerful, you know, with social justice issues and things like that, or just difficult, you know, ideas or controversial ideas. If people can laugh about it as well, it kind of seems to break the barriers a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to play some clips through the show from your stand-up show, I Am Not Malala. So let's hear the first one now. This is Sadia Azmat, I Am Not Malala.
I love this type of audience. You don't just start clapping because someone came on stage. I really appreciate you coming. Don't mind the cameras, okay? I'm under surveillance. That wasn't a joke. 24 hours. Okay, so thanks for coming, even though I'm not Malala. I would have loved to have invited Malala, but I'm pretty sure she's studying. So does everybody here know who Malala is? Yeah? That's not positive enough. Okay, so in case you weren't planning on being here or you're a plus one, Malala is the girl who stood up for education to the Taliban. It's pretty good, right? Because when I told my friends the show's called I Am Not Malala, they were like, we know you're not Malala, you're Sadia. So here are the ways I'm similar to Malala. We're Asian and we're women. That's it. Malala's a proper Asian. She grew up in Pakistan. I may look Asian, but I'm not the full package. It's true. I was born in London. I'm not married. I don't cook. I can't Bollywood dance. And my white friends, they're not racist, but they are race curious. That's why you're here. They hang around with me in the hopes that Asian shit will happen. They think if they hang around with me long enough, they're bound to see an arranged marriage. Or me playing the sitar. I feel like I'm not Asian enough for them. Like, I know things were hard for Malala in Pakistan. Women in the Swat Valley weren't allowed to go shopping. Not even online. But because she was an Asian girl growing up in an Asian culture, she's got a strong sense of identity. But being British Asian, it just confuses my friends. They're like, so where are your parents from? I say India. They're like, wow, that's great. I'm like, is it? Since when was race a compliment? Have you ever had someone be too positive about your race? Only white people in the audience today. They so badly want to convince you they're not racist. They seem pretty racist. My boss would say, black people are great. They dance really well. I f***ed a black guy once. They're so positive about your race. I was like, I don't feel this strongly about my race. Am I racist? Like, I'm always letting one of the sides down. I don't look British, but I don't get the Asian references. Like, you know, I was born in the same hospital as Prince Harry, St. Mary's Hospital in Paddington. But when people come up to me, they're like, so what's the weather like in Qatar? And I wonder what I can do to feel more British around white people. Go to the opera. Eat bland food. See dead people? What? Because only white people get contacted by the afterlife. White people humour ghosts because they're white too. They get into a conversation with a ghost. People say to me, hey, do you believe in ghosts? I'm like, well, there's no Asian ghosts. If I was a ghost, why would I want to come back? Who would I come back to? It's not like I could visit my parents. They'd be like, you can't even die properly.
Well, that was Sadia Azmat, my special guest from the arts this week, and a clip from her stand-up show, I Am Not Malala. In the first two clips we've heard, you've talked about the perception of Asians and also about the issue of identity and how we need to find a place in the world where we feel we fit. I'm wondering whether part of what you're trying to communicate in your work is that we all need to belong, but we don't necessarily all have to be the same to do that.
Yes, that, I think you've touched on the point there. For me, individuality is a huge, important thing. And I think because I am usually very conscious that I'm kind of classified with a whole group, rather than, so I'm classified with all the Asians or all the Muslims. I'm always looked at in a collective form rather than individually. So that's why I think it comes out that I'm really wanting to kind of in part that actually we're very different. Like, you know, even Muslims, like, although there's a way that you pray, I would probably, no two Muslims will pray exactly the same. And, you know, it's just a way of trying to show that we are different. And that's, I think that's really, really important.
Mm. Yeah, well, especially, you know, in terms of stereotyping, you know, how people are, are seen, yeah. You have a feature you do on Bendit TV on YouTube called Uncovered, where you address issues in the news from a British Asian perspective. And
yeah.
You don't pull any punches. I'm wondering if you're ever concerned about being so outspoken about Muslim issues in terms of the reaction it might engender.
To be honest with you, here's a joke. If I was, you know, if anything was to happen, I could always put on that face covering, like the niqab, and then I guess no one could recognise me. I'm just joking. To be honest with you, I think I could be more candid, and, you know, that's just my style, and I think you can't afford to pull any punches. You've just got to tell it how it is. And if comedians stopped doing that, then I wouldn't, you know, it would be a very sad place to live in, really. And I guess with Uncovered, what I was trying to do is just kind of talk about things. I mean, I think, to be fair with you, I think the media is very kind of the same way I am, just in the other direction from a different angle. I think the media is very insensitive towards Asians quite regularly. So it's quite natural for me to come up from the same angle, but just giving a different point of view.
Mm. I guess what I was meaning actually is that you're quite critical of certain Muslim issues. And so I wondered if you were concerned about Muslims being upset about what you're saying.
I suppose you're right. There is a, I guess the people who maybe don't, are not familiar with my style could take offence. But I think people who are familiar with my style, as we've just kind of touched upon, would realise that I'm not speaking on behalf of the whole kind of community in any way or form. I'm giving my view, and if people are going to take offence to that, then, you know, I have an entitlement to voice that, and I think it's very important to do so. And I'm really open to people disagreeing with me or having their own views, and I wouldn't be, you know, upset with them for feeling differently. So it's really important to be able to voice that kind of perspective. But I understand, no, I'm not really worried about people being upset about it, because, you know, they could stop watching, you know.
Yes, yeah.
You don't have to watch it, right?
I was just thinking, you know, your whole skit is I am not Malala, but I was thinking in some ways you are making a stand, you know. And well, she was, as you point out, she wasn't actually making a stand. She was just trying to go to school. But, you know, it's a sort of implicit stand of civil rights, really, to be able to express yourself and do what you want as a human being, isn't it? And make choices that you want to about that.
Mm. It's interesting how people like her, their intention is the noble one, to be educated, and they don't necessarily directly go out there to become that kind of role model in as a civil rights movement, but she has become that, and it was unintentional, despite the kind of humanitarian work she was doing with the BBC from a very young age. And I think I Am Not Malala is again, it's kind of trying to say that we are not all that one person from a particular race that you know or that you idolise. For example, a lot of my friends who are black, when President Obama was elected, a lot of people went up to my black friends and said, congratulations, like they're related to President Obama. So it's almost like, yeah, I'm not Obama or I'm not Malala. And it's just like, look, I am me, and I'm glad that you like the work she did. I had nothing to do with it, but, you know, go and give her your thanks rather than...
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's hear another clip now. This is Sadia Azmat.
My parents don't even know I'm a comedian. Oh, they know I'm an idiot, just not professionally. I can't tell them, you know. I have a sensible day job, it pays. If I said I'm a comedian, they'd be like, are you a lesbian? We've got some lesbians in the house. Or bi, or tri, I don't know. It's good to try. So I had to tell them I'd be at the Fringe for a few weeks. So I said, I'm going on holiday. They said, Asians don't go on holiday. So I said, look, I just need a break. They said, why Scotland? I said, I like shortbread and tartan and bagpipes. And they said, are you a lesbian? I always thought of bagpipes as more phallic. Like, most acts are afraid of getting bad reviews. I'm scared of getting any press coverage. In case they find out. You know, if they saw me in the paper, they'd be like, what are you doing in the paper? Asians only in the news when it's bad, unless it's Malala and you're not Malala. Thing is, right, I'm really scared of my parents. I'm not scared of anyone as much as I'm scared of them. I'm less frightened of the Taliban than I'm frightened of my parents. That's true, right? Because the Taliban can only harm me physically. Asian parents kill you psychologically. And growing up, right, it was always my white friends. Their parents would say stuff to them like, you're so special, you're so special. My parents would say, you're lucky. Lucky you got a roof over your head and you're not starving like the kids in India. But I always thought it was white people that are pretty lucky. I mean, white people are lucky. That's why you've got stuff like concept art. You've got to be lucky to pull that shit off. Do you know how Tracy Emin came into prominence? By an unmade bed. I cannot get my head around this. If I never made my bed, it would be seen as an act of defiance that cannot be tolerated. My mum would come into my room and ruin the art project by making the bed. It would be called the unwillingly made bed. Tracy's bed, right, it was scattered with cigarettes, tights, used condoms. I'm probably just like Tracy, a little messy, but I'm not called creative and evocative. It's called being a slob, Tracy. Last month, right, this art collector paid £2.2 million for Tracy's unmade bed. I could buy a small one-bedroom flat for that in London. Another piece of Tracy's seminal work was a tent. This was just a tent with the names of everyone that Tracy's ever slept with stitched on it. This sold for £40,000. The art world went crazy for this. She received critical acclaim. Tracy knows how to be exposed. She's a genius. Now, I've slept with one guy in my life, but if I was in India and devised a tent and stitched this one guy's name on it, that would be the quickest honor killing in history. They wouldn't even destroy the tent. They'd leave it in the center of town as an example to other would-be concept artists.
And it's because... Well, that was Sadia Azmat, my special guest from the arts this week. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore, and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel, and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my special guest from the arts, British stand-up comedian and comedy writer, Sadia Azmat. And I wanted to let you know, if you want more information about Sadia, you can go to her website, sadiaazmat.com, and that's S-A-D-I-A-A-Z if you're in England, or Z if you're in America, M-A-T, sadiaazmat.com. And if you search her on YouTube, you'll find a lot of stuff as well. So I love that part in that last clip we played about concept art. It's really funny and poignant, that part about the tent at the end. And I was thinking it's, you know, unique to comedy and talking about issues like that. You know, how sad it is, you know, you're talking about, you know, the honor killing, and yet we're laughing as well. It's an interesting combination to feel painful things and laugh. Also, you know, I mean, that's kind of how comedy works, isn't it? And helps us to accept things. Yeah.
I think the things you're not able to talk about, they have a certain power or, you know, control. When you start laughing at it, it makes it less scary. So particularly like with that honor killing joke, it's like, you know, if you can put it in its place rather than if you not talking about something, it has a lot more power over you.
Yeah, I think also... I mean, unfortunately,
there is so much going on in the world that isn't great. And with the media coverage now, we're so bombarded with all these terrible things that I think also it can be, become people sort of shut down in a way and don't really address certain things because they just feel like they can't cope. And so I think also that's something comedy can do. It sort of allows people to process something and think about it in a way that doesn't sort of shut them down, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It makes them open. I think a lot of people who go out to a comedy show, they kind of switch off from their daily troubles, their daily, you know, schedules, and they'll just go out there with an open mind and relax. So they're open to more different ways of looking at things. And I think that, you know, you will sometimes find that there's a disconnect between the media coverage and what's actually going on in the world. Because the other day, it was a really sunny day in the weekend and everyone was happy, summer holidays. And then like my Twitter feed was going crazy with, like, you know, crazy stuff going on around the world. But then you look outside your window and I think Bill Hicks said that as well, like, where is all this stuff happening? Because, like, sometimes it's like it's not always like that, but then there's never a good news story day, kind of. It's always bad stuff that you hear on the news.
No, that's very true. And I think it also distorts the percentage of bad things happening in the world. I mean, I think there's a lot more non-events and happy things happening than there are bad things, but it doesn't feel like that, as you point out, when with the media. You say your parents don't know you're a comedian. Is that still true, or have they found out now?
No, it's still true, and people don't believe me. And I'm telling you, as I told you before, as a comedian, the truth is very important to me. I'm not going to say I don't ever embellish stories, but this is very real. Like, I've had reviews in The Guardian, The Independent, and, you know, I'm looking forward to them finding out, because people do wonder, like, you know, oh, are they going to flip out? Are they going to go and get you married? Like, what's going to happen if they find out? And it's not that anything's going to happen. It's just I'd like them to find out. And it's more I'd like to show them than tell them. Especially, you know, how Asian parents are. And this is me being a bit stereotypical, but I suppose there's some truth with my parents that they like deliverables. They like tangibles. They like, you know, a pie chart. This is, as a comedian, this is how many gigs I've done this year. You know, they'd like a presentation as such. And it's not that type of a job, really, where you have that kind of career path. And sometimes it's a tumultuous journey where there's, like, you know, it finds you rather than you always finding it. So I'm looking forward to them finding out, and I'm hoping one day, you know, I'll switch on the TV and then they might recognize me.
I can understand that. I mean, the arts is, as you say, it's not a straight journey, and sometimes I think it's even non-Asian parents, you know, don't always understand that. You know, they want their children to be sort of safe and secure and have a certain, you know, path. And so I can totally understand why you want to be, you know, in a certain place, or at least allowed to just get on with what you're doing without that kind of input. Well, let's hear another clip now from I Am Not Malala. Sorry.
So I started wearing the scarf when I came of age, and some of you might think that I'm oppressed because I wear the scarf, and I understand, but we all cover something, right? You draw the line there, I draw the line there. You know, I'm comfortable covering my hair the same way you're comfortable covering your and it's not for me to say that you're oppressed by your top and your bra. And some people say to me, you should take off the scarf in the name of feminism. And I'm like, is that what we're doing now? Like, is it the more clothes I take off, the more feminist I am? So if I was walking down the Royal Mile naked, would I be the best feminist? And as much as I'm not comfortable with people telling me to take stuff off, I'm also not comfortable with people telling me to put stuff on. Like, recently I was walking down the street, this Asian guy religiously dressed stopped me. I was wearing as much as I am now, and he said, cover it up. You should cover it up. And I was like, have you got x-ray vision, mother? What the f*** can you see? I do draw the line at covering my face because I'm a stand-up comedian. I mean, where the hell would the mic go? Thing is, right, once I started wearing the scarf, people started treating me like I was really religious. Like my white friends, Angie and Tina, they would police the scarf. They'd be like, no smoking around Sadia, no swearing around Sadia, no shooting up around Sadia. And they'd say stuff to me like, you're really good, you're so good. I didn't know what they meant. I mean, if wearing a scarf meant that I was good, my actions couldn't keep up with my appearance quickly enough. I never thought wearing a scarf would be a big deal because you don't notice the changes right away. But slowly, some people started to keep their distance from me. It has its advantages. I've never been stopped by street charity fundraisers. Some people are so uncomfortable by the scarf, they can't stop referring to it. They'll be like, oh, that's a beautiful scarf you've got on. What's the upkeep like? How does it work in the shower?
Oh, it's very funny, that clip. From a feminist perspective, the reason there's an issue with women covering up, whether it be wearing a scarf or avoiding mini skirts or whatever, is it's part of the whole belief system that men don't need to be in charge of their own sexual urges and needs, and that somehow it's up to women to moderate them for them through their behaviour. So I'm wondering what your perspective is on men being responsible for their own sexuality and their own needs, rather than women being put in the position of controlling men's arousal.
I totally agree with you. I definitely think that they need to hold it down in a way that sometimes they fail to do. But the truth is, I don't really think it is about what a woman is wearing, you know, whether she is fully covered or wearing a miniskirt. Unfortunately, like, you know, some men, they just don't have that control. Like, one time I was wearing like a full burqa, not on my face, but I was like fully dressed. I don't know what the occasion was. And some guy groped my butt, you know what I mean? So it really isn't to do with what you're wearing. And I know, you know, I think...
Isn't that an argument, though, that, you know, against covering up? Because, you know, it's like, if they're going to be like that, they're going to be like that anyway. So why do you need to increase the modesty by, you know, trying to make yourself kind of, you know, your body non-evident?
I think what it means is that a man doesn't need encouragement, because the way they rationalise it, if they do rationalise it, you know, they'll convince themselves of anything. So I think in my perspective, they might have thought, you know, oh, she's a good girl, and that's what perhaps the attraction in that instance was. And for example, then they'll justify it if a girl is maybe more casually dressed, that she, you know, she is interested or she's that way inclined. So I don't think that... I think the way a person dresses is very personal, and I think especially as a woman, it's up to you what you want to wear, what you feel comfortable in. I don't think that you should be forced to dress in a certain way, and I think that they're two separate issues, because some women, they feel comfortable in loose dresses or modest dress, and some women, they feel comfortable in more fashionable dresses, and either there's no right or wrong. We all like to look good. There's different ways of, you know, feeling comfortable and looking, you know. I think society can be very tough on women, you know, because sometimes even in the professional environment, if you're dressed a bit too scantily, you'll be labelled a certain way. So there's always wider issues, and almost like in comedy where women, you know, have that accessibility issue, you know, unfortunately it's in other fields as well. So I think there's two separate issues, and unfortunately one is more vocalised in terms of how women, what the woman's responsibility is for provoking a man, and the other, there is no noise on men controlling their urges. I hardly ever hear, apart from you raising it in this interview, I hardly ever hear the need for men to moderate themselves and be more modest in their gaze or in their approach.
So you're saying that it's not brought up very often about men's responsibility, but I think that that's what really I don't like about it. But it sounds like what you're saying is that your choice of wearing a scarf is more about your sense of how you want to present your body and what you want to expose. So you're not doing it because you're wanting to provide less temptation to men who can't control their urges.
No, definitely not. I think, you know, I think it's not a constant as well, if I'm honest with you. I think there are times where, you know, you... Like when I started wearing the scarf, I was a bit more traditional or formal with it. It was a bit more kind of special. And then, you know, the novelty wears off of you being a kind of person wearing it, and then, you know, it just becomes this kind of accessory. Well, it's not an accessory, sorry, but it becomes this, it becomes natural, like your trousers or like your other wear garments. And I don't have strong views about people wearing it or not wearing it. I definitely think it's individual choice. And I think, yes, there are those kind of reasons behind why people are encouraged to wear it. There just isn't enough noise on the other side about men's responsibilities, and I think that's very it kind of reflects society about how there are those imbalances, unfortunately, between men and women. So it's not just coming from the religious angle.
No, absolutely. That's why I brought up about miniskirts, because, you know, it's talked about a lot from an Islamic perspective, you know, and people feeling, you know, outraged that women are having to cover up, you know, or whatever. But it's equally true of the whole, you know, where she was asking for it being raped because she had a short skirt on. I mean, you know, it's all part of this bigger sort of concept that somehow it's women's responsibility to moderate men's sexual behavior, you know. So
sometimes, it feels like there's a narrative of accepted sexism, which is disturbing, and which is why it's really important that there's a load of, you know, good, strong female representatives in all sorts of different arrays of professions, and just speaking out, like Tina Fey, like yourself, just giving out the different vibe that, you know, we're not defined by how we look. And it's so important, because unfortunately first impressions, they mean a lot, and people will latch onto them, especially in these kind of times where people are so busy and very switched on to technology all the time. They're getting all these updates and stuff. They will give less consideration than ever before. So it's important that we keep raising that we are not defined by our appearance.
Yes, yeah. We just got a couple of minutes left, so I did want to ask you, I know you're working on a new stand-up show. Can you give us a little sort of teaser what that might cover?
Yes, so my working title of the show is called I Know What You Did Last Syria. And I think, because I'm based in London, and I know that a lot of girls, there were three girls from Bethnal Green that went to join ISIS. And because they live really close to me geographically, I was really shocked, because, you know, they have the modern background, the modern upbringing. They were raised here in London, and I had pretty much similar upbringing, and that's not anything I would ever consider. So it's got me, you know, really, really intrigued. And rather than just listening to the media, which only talks about one side of the issue, which is the utopian society that is presented by that faction, I was looking into it a bit more deeply. So I'm doing a lot of research, getting in touch with, you know, professors, people in the field, and getting loads of different kind of stories and insights. And so my kind of stand-up show is going to be talking about that, because I know it's touched people from all over the world, and there's a lot of good work being done to prevent this from happening as well, that I don't think gets attention as well. So I'm just going to try and lift the lid on how it's more about human character than kind of some sort of looking to go to paradise, if you like.
Yeah. Oh, well, that sounds very interesting. We'll look forward to that. Well, thank you so much, Sadia, for making the time to talk to us. It was great hearing more about your art. And I just want to tell listeners again, they can go to sadiaazmat.com if they want more information. So thanks so much. And
thank you.
Good luck with the new show.
Thank you ever so much. All the best.
Yes, to you too. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland. I look forward to seeing you next week. Remember that you can check out podcasts on the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can hear past shows. You can hear this show again. Tell your friends about it and connect with me on social media. I'll see you next week.